You're listening to the Oklahoma Memo Podcast, the fastest way to get smart on Oklahoma news, politics, business, and sports.
Welcome to the Oklahoma Memo Podcast. My name is Ryan Welton, the founder and curator of your daily local news recap called Oklahoma Memo. Hit your inbox Monday through Saturday at 7 a.m. Sign up at oklahomamemo.com/subscribe. And now it is time for our Friday conversation with Grant Herms, the curator and operator of Make It Make Sense with Grant Herms. How you doing, Grant?
I'm good. Curator makes it sound so like upper class, so fancy. I like that.
The other term that they use a lot nowadays is operator.
Ooh, operator. Ooh, hey.
Well, for folks who are not aware, Grant is writing and doing videos on all things politics nationally. He used to be in Oklahoma City at News 9. So if he looks familiar, there's a reason why. There's a lot going on relative to Oklahoma that is impacting national, isn't it?
Yes. Yes, there is. Absolutely. It's funny you mentioned News 9 because this week I for a video I did, I like dug up a little clip of myself at the desk at News 9 and had not looked at my face from that long ago. It was probably 10 years ago. And you might not recognize me anymore. I look pretty different. I feel old looking at that.
Anytime I've seen photos or videos of myself from my 20s, I think to myself, I mean,
yeah,
that's me.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. It's like crazy. I'd kill to have that body again. That'd be great. Yeah. Yeah.
I totally, man, I tell you, once you hit 50, all the bones start aching. It's a real thing. And I remember when I was at News 9, one of my employees, Anna, she'd say, don't let the old man in. Don't let the old man in. The Clint Eastwood thing, I believe Toby Keith had a song by that name.
It's
a mentality.
Yeah.
Hey, it's been super busy this week.
Yes.
Maybe we finally have reached a week where it's not as crazy as the week before, but it's still been kind of crazy, and there's a lot going on in Oklahoma. Oklahoma Memo viewers, listeners, subscribers know that Kevin Hearn announced this week that he was going to move from CD1 to an attempt to get elected to the Senate. Are you hearing anything about that?
It's causing little ripples right now. The big thing is that Kevin Hearn isn't a shoo-in for that race, but he could have maybe the biggest impact there. I mean, his campaign war chest, the money that he's built up for that race, is the largest amount for that right now. And so he's got the biggest head start. And it might be the only start that anybody could need. It could end up just being his seat because of that. Because what we're talking about here for a primary is really 90 days, roughly, for this primary race. And then because it's Oklahoma, you know, there's a general, but like, you know, the Republican who wins the primary is going to win the general for this seat more than likely, you know, vastly more than likely. So Kevin Hearn, if he runs away with the primary because he's got all this money, is probably going to be the next senator. And the rumblings that are happening among Republicans on Capitol Hill in the House is, well, here we go, is that they have a super, super slim margin. Like, we were talking, depending on the day of the week, a 1-2 vote margin to victory on any bill. And if now they've got this race in CD1 in which Democrats could potentially put up an actual challenger in CD1 in time and in a year in which Democrats are going to be turning out to vote. That's a race that they weren't expecting to need to have. This is the kind of thing that we were talking about last week when we talked, or was it 2 weeks ago now? What is time anymore, really?
Nice.
You know, when we talked about how while Mullen may have felt like the safe choice from one standpoint, there was this other sort of backdoor thing that I was thinking about where it opens up this part of this where it's this all of a sudden Republicans have to think about throwing money at a race in Oklahoma. Like, what are we talking about here? And so that's sort of the rumblings, is that as some of these people who do the electoral math in the House are looking at this and sort of walking a couple steps down, they're like, well, if we lose Hearn in Oklahoma and we need every single warm body we can, like, all of a sudden we're fighting in places that we shouldn't be fighting, and what's going to happen now? And so that's really interesting. And obviously nobody is going to tell Kevin Hearn not to run for a Senate seat. And even if they did, even if Mike Johnson did, the Speaker of the House, they're not going to stop him from doing that. You know, it's not that every representative wants to be a senator. It's just that most of them do.
There's a lot of prestige, and frankly, there's a lot of money to be made. Kevin Hearn and his stocks.
Yes. Well, and also, like, you know, when you're a senator, you only run once every 6 years instead of every other year, and that's just a nice way to live. You're not running for re-election, you know, basically when you get re-elected to the House, you have 6 months of not campaigning, and then you campaign again. You're making donor phone calls right away. Like, it's exhausting, and not, you know, the tiniest violin, right, for that part of the job, but like that part of it is exhausting and demanding, and there are demands of the party when you're in the House, and so those things on both sides of the aisle are time sucks and not why they often want to do the job. And so, like, being a senator, you get a little more time to, like, do the stuff of being a politician that's oftentimes they want to be elected to do. And then, yes, the money. And then, especially when you're a senator, there's more power. There's more weight. There's stuff that, like, we'll talk about in a little bit here, but, like, there's more stuff in the Senate that the Constitution requires of you than requires of the House. And so, yeah, there's some prestige with that he wants, for sure.
So I'm glad you mentioned that, because growing up, I mean, I was a presidential nerd, a politics nerd, a political science nerd. And I always understood that really, if you were elected to the House of Representatives, you were there to represent the will of the people. But Senate was supposed to be a body of thinkers, with high ideals thinkers who don't necessarily go along with whatever the constituents want just because.
Yeah, the idea is that it's, there is an old saying that the Senate is two for the party, two for the country, two for the constituent, 2 years, that is. And the idea is that if the House, because the turnover is every 2 years, every other year, there's an election, which means that you could be voted out, it's closer to the people, and therefore maybe a little more chaotic, a little more raucous, and that makes it a little more roiling. And the Senate is supposed to cool that off. It's the idea is that it's the cooling saucer for the hot cup of tea that is the House. I can't remember which founding father said that. I think it was Jefferson, but don't exactly quote me on that one. And that's the idea. It's kind of morphed away from that in recent years as things have gotten more and more polarized. But senators still certainly see themselves as that, and they take their jobs seriously in that way. Certainly the current Majority Leader John Thune sees himself that way and sees the Senate as a body that way. So it is interesting to talk about this in this day and age, these bodies pretending and feeling like that. And for Kevin Hearn to step into this race in this way and clearly have designs on the Senate in that way, too. So I think that's important. The other thing that I'm hearing as well is, you know, the people who are going to be nominated to replace Mullen for now, or be appointed to replace Mullen, I should say, is all over the map. You know, we were talking beforehand, and I don't want to, like, tell tale out of school here, but, like, my money would have been on Harold Hamm. I know that you and Scott Mitchell have been hearing some other things. I think Hamm would be a decent pick because the president could use some help from an ally right now in the Senate specifically, which has been not, you know, antithetical to the president, not adversarial to the president, but they're not in lockstep with him in the way that the House is. And Harold Hamm, especially being a mega donor, a longtime ally and friend of the president, especially as the president is maybe a little bit over his skis in Venezuela right now, which we've largely turned away from, but things aren't going as well in Venezuela as the president would like on the ground. And certainly it looks like the war in Iran, which I know we're going to talk about later, that is spiraling out of the White House's control in a way that is impacting the oil markets. And so having somebody at least in a seat in the Senate that can help, let's say, push or guide the president's vision on what to do with the oil markets that would come from someone like Harold Hamm right now would be beneficial for the president for the next several months.
I wonder, Governor Kevin Stitt went to D.C. This week, and he met with President Trump. At first, I think it was said that he wasn't, or he was, then he wasn't. But he ended up doing that. Could this have been sort of an olive branch between Stitt and the president in case the governor wants to run for Senate and he needs Trump's help?
That's certainly possible. That is a thing that you do in these situations. I would be surprised if Trump is willing to bury the hatchet on this. He has publicly gone after Stitt several times this year or in the last year. Stitt endorsed DeSantis, which is an unforgivable sin if you're Donald Trump. And Trump holds grudges. That's what he does. Excuse me. He doesn't bring people back into the fold very well unless they like are the J.D. Vances or Marco Rubios and do full capitulations. And that's not something that Stitt's going to do, not as the leader of the National Governors Association and not as somebody who isn't being promised a cabinet position. And so unless Kevin Stitt was like going to get guaranteed a Senate seat somehow, which he can't, there's just no way that I think Kevin Stitt's going to do what Trump wants, which is full fealty and loyalty. And I'm not sure Stitt is that person anyway. He doesn't strike me as that kind of guy, but I would have said that about Marco Rubio a year and a half ago anyway. So, it's hard to know those things in the light of Donald Trump.
Well, especially the recent incarnation of Governor Stitt would lead you to believe that he wouldn't be like that. He's been his own man for at least the past 18 months, but it's really started to accelerate. And if you were, so the thought is that Stephanie Bice may step away from CD5 to run for Senate also, depending on how she thinks she can do against Hearn, and that Stitt might run for Senate in a way to sort of like catapult himself to a presidential run. But if you're Governor Stitt and you don't feel really good about making a Senate run, risking a loss, do you even bother? Do you even bother?
I don't think so. I think, I also think that abandoning a congressional district for a Senate seat is looked on a lot more favorably than abandoning a governor's office for a Senate seat. Yes, at a governor and Senate seat, they are still state-to-state seats, right? Those are still statewide elections. But it feels different because it is different. It's an executive abandoning an entire state for a federal position. And
although he would still be governor while he's running.
Yes, while he's running. But like that would make him pretty unpopular. It would feel like he's clout chasing. It would feel like he's chasing all the negative things that we think about the Senate. And that's a hard road to hoe. If I'm Kevin Stitt and I've got designs on the presidency, the easier path, generally speaking, although not entirely, this has shifted over time. But like the easier path is, Senate to president. And I'm kicking myself that like our election cycle in Oklahoma doesn't fall in this line, right? It's not a 26 election, it's a 28 election kind of a thing. And so like bad timing, right? But in some ways too, it's not so bad. I think that he can still finish out his term as governor, be a prominent voice in the way that he's been, remain this guy. I think we'll see more of him in the public eye. He's got a lot of time to build up some money and some cachet nationally. I think we're going to see more of him publicly. I think that it's easier for him to write the narrative of Kevin Stitt as a presidential candidate and not get bogged down in having to write a narrative of Kevin Stitt the governor, then Kevin Stitt the senator, and then Kevin Stitt the candidate. That political jump is really difficult for somebody. And yes, we saw Obama do it, but Obama is a very unique political creature in American history, right? That is a unique political story. He's a unique political animal that is just one of those stories. Very, very few people in American history are those things. I would say Trump is also his own unique political animal in that way too, coming so far from the outside. So yeah, I think that there are pros and cons to this for Kevin Stitt, but I think that this might actually benefit him more in the long run, because it doesn't look great if you walk away from your state as governor.
Because again, he would still be governor, but all his time would be focused on this senatorial run.
Mm-hmm.
But besides, I will tell you, Grant, everything I've heard from a variety of sources is that Governor Stitt's eye is on a presidential run.
Yeah. I mean, he seems to be gearing up for that. He is doing things that are clearly in the vein of like trying to put his name out there on a much more national stage. The NPR interview is that thing. He's doing a lot with the Times, the New York Times. He's done a couple of sit downs and profiles with them.
Well, also Career Ladder.
Yeah.
TikTok show.
Yeah.
You don't do that if you're running for Senate.
No. You don't do that if you're running for Senate in California, let alone Oklahoma, right? So, like, it's just in terms of population. He's got his eye on a much larger population of voters, and the next step up is president. And that's just where he's going. I think that's okay. And I think that from a standpoint of being able to go from a business executive to a government executive to a national government executive, that's a pretty good run and a pretty traditional one too, and one that in a post-Trump Republican Party might be appealing to a lot of people. That's in the water supply right now for a lot of non-MAGA Republicans who don't have a home in this Republican Party right now. They exist. That's there.
So, Governor Stitt, the news in Oklahoma yesterday was that Governor Stitt has decided not to make this appointment until after Senator Mullen is confirmed. Is that telling at all? Is there concern?
Yeah, there is concern. It's part of that is because we don't know when that could happen. And it is interesting that Stitt is saying confirmed. And I don't know if he just means in the job.
I should note, that's my word. That's my until. I don't know that he said so, confirmed, but he said I'm not naming it until after Senator Mullen is in the position.
Okay. So that's okay. I thought you were actually like saying that he had said confirmed, and that was a thing I hadn't heard yet. So technically, Mullen takes over the job on April Fool's Day. Right, he takes over the job on April 1st, which is like a bad day to start any job. Like,
right.
You're gonna get pranked at your first day of work at the new job, like all day long. That sucks. Like, you think they would put snakes in his boots?
Or his Florsheim shoes.
Right. Oh God. Right. For those of you who don't know, the president has been buying. He has these shoes, these Florsheim shoes, which are these sort of moderately expensive brand of shoes. And he has been attempting to size up all the men that he works with, and then he will just buy them these specific shoes, often getting their sizes wrong, and then they have been reportedly too afraid to not wear them. And he bought, like, Marco Rubio shoes that were clearly two sizes too big, but Marco Rubio was wearing them around, and they're, like, it's very weird and, like, a little... It's a little Stalin-y, to be honest. Like, it's a little, like, here's your uniform you must wear kind of a thing. But, like, and also, weird. Just weird.
But right. I mean, who, yeah. Well, again, I think it's odd that the president has decided, I can guess your shoe size.
Like, it's a fun carnival trick, kind of a thing.
Right.
Yeah. It'd be one thing if he was like good at it, like if he was like, this is my special talent, I can guess your shoe size.
Right.
And he was like dead on. I'm here for that. That's fun. But like this other thing, not so much. And anyway, so like, I think that I think that Stitt is waiting because he wants to see what happens with Mullen in the Senate, because it's not a done deal. Yes, senators like to confirm their own for lots of reasons that we could talk about in a minute. But there are real concerns that Mullen might not get in. There are concerns about his actual credibility for running this department, which is now bigger than it's ever been. Following somebody like Kristi Noem, there are real concerns that Mullen is going to follow suit, both in terms of how Kristi Noem spent money and in terms of how Kristi Noem, according to federal judges, abused the law and abused civil rights of Americans. And that's concerning to a lot of senators because they didn't think that the Trump administration was going to go that far. There are concerns that that DHS won't open again because it's still partially shut down, and that Democrats are going to hold this nomination up versus opening DHS. Like I said last week, you need to get Mullen, you can get DHS, take your pick. And so I think that they're sort of waiting for the dust to settle on this thing. And then there's the added thing that the president wants the Save America Act to pass so badly that he has said he's not going to sign off on anything until that passes, which seems to include Mullen's confirmation. And now Mullen could be appointed as the acting secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. Totally possible. He can only serve in that position for 210 days. He would have more or less all the same powers as a regular secretary. But after that, he couldn't go back to being a senator. So there's also that.
So there's a risk for him. I mean, maybe right. Mullen is not that he's rethinking or anything, but he might have to be actively thinking about this. And at some point, if it looks like he's not going to get a fair shake or he's not going to get confirmed, he may say, you know what? I'm good being senator. Where, you know, that would be chaos.
It would be chaos. I don't think Mullen is the guy who could look Trump in the face and say no to a nomination. I think there are very few Republicans alive right now who could do that. But also Mullen is the guy who like pretended to stand up to fight a Teamster and then got told by Bernie Sanders to sit down. It was like, yeah, okay. And so, you know, when push comes to shove, Mullen chickened out. So like, I don't think Mullen has it in him for that thing is what I mean.
And
like,
he said, this is the time, this is the place.
Stand your butt up. Yeah. Right. Which is how we knew he wasn't serious, but I don't think Mullen will be the person to say, you know, like, I want to stay senator. It's just, I don't think that's in him. And also like, it's a big deal to be nominated for DHS. Especially right now,
to be part of the cabinet at all.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, he doesn't want to say no to that either. And also risk some kind of Senate primary down the road from somebody who, you know, who will hold this grudge against him for some reason or something like that. So, yeah, absolutely. I'm wondering if Stitt is trying to figure out some of this electoral math as well. I'm wondering if he's trying to figure out if House Republicans or the party or Senate Republicans are trying to figure out what their moves are and if he's talking to them as well before he appoints somebody to this seat so that they could say, okay, we have our ducks in a row. Go ahead and put in your placeholder. And that way we can all play nice together and things can stay even keel until whatever happens with the nomination and or the election happens. And I think probably the name of the game right now among everybody involved in these conversations is steady versus anything else. Yeah.
So one of the things I always admire about Make It Make Sense with Grant Herms is that you learn a little something, whether it be things you forgot from civics class or whatever it might be. And you had a piece this week about the cabinet and how, you know, that process. What can we learn?
Sure. So that was the things you forgot from civics class newsletter this week, which drops on Mondays. It is the civics lesson that I do every week, and it's how the cabinet gets made. And basically, I thought it was important to go over this again for those of us who just kind of forgot how this worked, because we're talking about Mullen getting this role. And basically how this works is the president can nominate anybody he wants. That's a part of the Constitution. The president gets to pick that. The founders thought that was important. The president gets to surround himself with the people that he thinks are right for the job. It does not have to be based on merit, although George Washington sort of started that as a tradition. And competency, you would like to be surrounded by people who are good at their jobs, that can inform you. And over time, the size of the cabinet has shifted. It started with four. It was Treasury, State, War, and the Post Office, which at that point in time was so important that they thought they had to make it a cabinet position. And then it got unceremoniously downgraded, I think, in like the 70s, and which I'm sure they're still burned by. And then we now have 15 cabinet positions that also include the CIA director, the director of national intelligence, the EPA director, the Small Business Association director, and then those can sort of transfer around. The president can pick and choose who's a cabinet level, but there are core ones that are all the departments that you hear about all the time.
I didn't even know that some of those that you named were cabinet level positions.
Yes.
What sort of access does a cabinet level secretary have that others don't?
They have access to the president in ways that others don't. They're required to report to the president based on the president's schedule and based on what the White House chief of staff sets as a schedule. So there's a mandatory cabinet meeting, and those used to be fairly rare, like, you know, twice a year, maybe sometimes once a year. The president now does one every month and he televises it. It's like his little board meeting that he likes to televise. And this, you know, those used to be really boring and they still kind of are, but they're kind of shows now. And they update the president on what's happening in their departments, or whether they're fulfilling their goals, their promises, those things. Those used to be much more important when they would meet, because they really were like business room board meetings to update the you know, CEO about what's happening. And now we see those things in real time. There's email, they're back and forth, they're calling, they're texting, that, you know, they get real time updates from these departments. So they're a little less important. But they do, depending on which department you're talking about, have pretty high clearances for a lot of these things. You know, the Department of Defense secretary, or, you know, rebranded to Department of War, they're not legally Department of War. You know, he's got top secret clearance. The FBI director has top secret clearance. The Homeland Security will have, I believe it's top secret clearance. I'm pretty sure it's top secret, if not fully high classified. They have all sorts of higher level access in that way. So it's not just a role in the government. They're overseeing thousands of employees, tens of thousands of employees for some of these positions. They are overseeing billions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars for some of these departments that are a little bit smaller, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars, a little bit smaller. These are crucial jobs. And the big thing, and we're talking about this confirmation with Senator Mullen, is that the Senate has built into the Constitution what's called an advise and consent role, which there's a clause in the Constitution that says that the Senate will advise and consent from time to time on public magistrate and counsel roles, which are these secretary roles, these department head roles. Not every single cabinet member right now is one of these roles, but every department head is. Every secretary of a thing is. And that means that the committee that will oversee this department, so in the case of Mullen, it is like the committees of Homeland Security and Oversight will have, you know, hearings with Mullen there, and they will question him about why he's the right guy for this job, and he'll have answers to those things. that used to not be the case. We didn't actually have our very first confirmation hearing until 1925, and that was for a Supreme Court justice. And then we didn't get these kinds of hearings until kind of the modern era. We also don't really get any real rejections of cabinet picks almost ever. In the history of the United States, there are like 9 total, which is crazy. The most anybody has had is the current president. And then withdrawals, there have also been a number of withdrawals, and the current president has also had the most of those as well, which is partly a commentary on the choices the president has made, but is much more a commentary on how polarized our politics is now than anything else. So there's that part of this. But that advice and consent role is taken really, really seriously among a lot of senators on both sides of the aisle. And it's one of the more crucial parts of the Senate itself. And when the founders created that part of this, they thought it was important, A, that it was in the Senate and not in the House, because of that thing that we talked about earlier, that the House, the turnover is more frequent, and therefore it's more raucous there and it's more chaotic. And so maybe that's not the best environment for a advisory board, I guess, role.
Right.
That's not a level-headed kind of place. Although I would argue that sometimes the Senate has not been recently either. It is a serious part of the gig of being senator, and a really interesting one that is a lot about, especially when it comes to Mullen right now, a lot about glad handing with his own peers in the Senate. Because what happens is, outside of these hearings, which for a lot of this is show, right? It's the spectacle of this. It's how they perform under pressure, which is kind of important, but also a little less so, depending on what department you're in. A lot of this gets done behind closed doors in one-on-one meetings with senators who have their own questions, who sometimes have questions that are about sensitive things, whether they're personal things, which could be in the case of something like some of Mullen's money stuff, his PPP loans, that they don't want to public embarrass him about, his private businesses, some of his stock money stuff, that Republicans on these committees would rather not ask him about publicly, but might have concerns about, maybe some of his past, some things in his past they might find, but also things about how they think he might run DHS in their states. Because a lot of these members sit on a committee that they sit on that committee for a reason, because their states are impacted by that committee or that department. So that's why they're there. And those meetings are more important generally than the hearings are. And it's important to know that in the Senate, every senator just about has designs on being president. They just do. Every senator thinks that they're going to be president someday and just winds up being a senator for a long time if they don't. But even then, still thinks they're going to be president someday. Bernie Sanders still thinks he's going to be president. He just does. And that's how they're wired. So senators tend to play nice with other senators who come up for confirmation hearings because they don't want to rock the boat, because they don't want to upend their chances of getting confirmed into a cabinet, because it looks really good on a presidential resume to have been a senator, then a cabinet member, and then running for president. Mm-hmm. In our conversation earlier about talking about how you become president. So that's how these cabinets are built and made. And it's an interesting process, and it's one that was really thought out. And there was a lot of kind of wisdom in it, even though Hamilton thought a lot of this was redundant and kind of unneeded. He had a little bit more faith in people in some of these instances than I think other founders did, like Madison. But it's a really interesting process, and one that, like I said, is a really carefully crafted one, even if it does feel like a lot of song and dance most of the time.
I have one piece of advice for Mark Wayne when he's in these hearings. He needs to let it slip out publicly what his shoe size is. So Yeah. It's 9.5.
Yeah. If you let me in, I will walk in the front door in my size 10.5 boots on the first day. And like,
Right. But my boots are this.
Yeah.
Dude, does Florsheim make boots? So I want to spring a question on you. Something I saw online. I want to know if it's true or not. Did President Trump send a letter or an email to high donors inviting them to national security access if they donated X amount of money?
Not really. The wording of this letter implied that, but it's more like access to people. Now, that's not great either, but it's not really any different than what happens at Mar-a-Lago at these like fundraiser dinners, these like, you know, $500,000 to $1 million plate dinners. That's really what he's doing here. And now that is still in a way selling access to these things, but he's not selling secrets for money directly. It's not a one-to-one transaction. So that's what's happening with that. It's not great. It's still, you know, people with who study ethics for a living are still like, you know, this is not
horrifying.
They're horrified, right? They're like, this is not how this is supposed to work. But it is not. He is not like, you know, opening up a trench coat and being like, I got secrets.
I'll tell you, the people right now who might want that kind of access work in the oil business because, you know, the Strait of Hormuz has become just a quagmire. And there is talk, Grant, of $300 per barrel oil. I mean, what is going on with that? And we're now in our second, third week of the war in Iran.
Yeah. So in the Strait of Hormuz, which for those of you who like don't know the geography of the Middle East very well, if you can kind of picture where Africa is, and it's like Africa's here, and then just up over here is Saudi Arabia, and then like Iran is over here, and then the Strait of Hormuz is this little piece that's right here that is this tiny strip of water where 20% of the world's oil gets shipped through from Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Qatar, and Iran. And Iran this week, after we had struck quite a few of their missile depots and drone depots and ship docks, they started putting mines out in the strait. That is not good. They have access to about 2,000 to 3,000 Russian and Chinese-made mines. They could be carried on small boats that can carry 2, 3, 4 of these mines at a time. You don't need very many of them in the water for them to be completely impassable for large tankers of oil.
And can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
Because, you know, growing up, I see a mine as sort of like this little round thing with spikes or whatever. So what are these mines? And when you say it's impassable, do you mean that a tanker would explode if it passed through waters where a mine was?
Yes. That, I mean, like, mines look just like that. They're, I'm not an explosive engineer, but basically how they work is, like, they have those little spikes are actually little detonators that, like, push in, kind of like the cap of a pen, and they hit a detonator, and it blows up. And so a tanker would go by, disturb this mine, the pressure, either getting close enough to a mine itself, and the water pressure pushing on that would press in the detonator, and then that would go, or it would hit it itself and it would blow up. That would either blow a hole in the tanker and it would leak oil everywhere into the Arabian Sea, which is equally bad, right? Like, so now you've got an ecological disaster in your hands, let alone a war happening. But then you've also got, you know, a sinking ship in the middle of a war happening, in the middle of an ecological disaster. We're talking salting the earth, basically, here. And the reason that Iran is doing this, because they also can't get ships through, is because they're like, what do we care? At this point, Israel has struck somewhere on the order of 30 oil refineries in Iran. And so Iran's oil industry has basically been crippled. And it's going to take them years to rebuild that. So they're like, great. Our end of this is screwed. And so we might as well, like, harm the other Gulf nations around us. That is going to have the knock-on effect of not only hurting the oil and gas industry, because a lot of the Gulf states also export natural gas, It's going to harm the plastics industries in Asia that need petroleum to make plastics. There are critical rare earth minerals and other things that we mine that are needed for like microchips and semiconductor chips that are made in places like South Korea and Japan, which have already started to sound the alarm over a slowing down of that industry. Metals and those things won't be as affected because we get those from other parts of the world, but the shipping industry, not doing so hot right now. And the president had said that we were going to, you know, let the Navy escort some of these tankers through. Well, two things happened there. First, these mines make that kind of impossible now. Second, early this week on, what was it, Tuesday, Christopher Wright, the Secretary of Energy, accidentally said, we'll say accidentally for now, said that the U.S. had successfully escorted a tanker through the Strait of Hormuz. That turned out not to be true. However, when he said that, oil was at $110 a barrel. After he said that, it went back down to $80 a barrel. The market was waiting for this thing to happen. It turned out not to be true. That post got taken down, but it did lead to a sort of oil rally for a little bit and an easing of tensions, which is exactly what the White House needed to give everybody a little bit of a breather. They're blaming this on a staffer who like inadvertently posted a video about him saying this at a public event. I'm doing some work right now on this. I don't want to get too far ahead of myself. It's a very weird thing for the Secretary of Energy to have said, having it not been true.
Right. Well, and also, I don't know if it was a couple of days or the president said that these tankers ought to have guts and just, I like in this,
yeah.
But you covered a lot of storms in your time in Oklahoma, so you're familiar with the concept of punching the hail core. They oftentimes, Val Castor loved to do, he'd punch the core, man, drive right through it.
Yeah. That's great. I mean, like, it's one thing to punch a hail core. It's another thing to punch the hail core if the hail also explodes when you hit it. Like, it's not the same thing. And also, you know, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars worth of oil on these tankers. And like, they're just not going to do it. The shipping companies aren't going to take the risk. Even if the United States says we're going to reimburse you for the risk, there's this thing called political risk insurance that the United States is offering some of these companies. And these companies are like, nah, kick rocks. Like, we're not doing that. That's not worth the money. So, you know, we could be looking at oil prices that are going to hit, you know, yes, rumors are swirling about $300 a barrel. I think we're going to probably, I don't know, break somewhere around 150 before things really get tight. And the White House is going to have to do something differently when it comes to, you know, what we're doing in Iran. But also, there was just a release this week of 400 million barrels of oil from the International Energy Association. IEA is the acronym. That's going to sustain the global market for just a few weeks. That's not going to be enough. We don't know how long fighting is going to continue. If the fighting stopped today, it would take several months to demine the Strait of Hormuz. So that's going to disrupt shipping, you know, until July. Again, if it stopped today, which it's not going to. And then senators got a 2-hour long briefing this week. And Senator Chris Murphy from Connecticut came out and had a pretty bleak assessment of what he heard and said, like, listen, there's no plan for dismantling a nuclear weapons program because we don't have anybody on the ground to assess where any of this is. So we don't even know where any of this nuclear material is, if it exists. And then he said there's no plan to reopen the Strait of Hormuz if they even know how. The plan right now seems to be to continue just to bomb missile depots and drone depots and ships, wait for Iran to rebuild, and then just continue to bomb forever and just continue to cripple Iran at every single turn. And that's a forever war. That's you're forever putting out this fire. It's a game of whack-a-mole in a way that this new Iranian regime, isn't going to stand for. And we also learned this week that while the president, yes, has been saying that we decimated Iran's leadership, internally, intelligence agencies are saying, actually, we didn't do that. And the top of this government is still pretty strong. And the son of Khomeini, the former Ayatollah, is now in power. And that, and since we have no plans for a regime change, because you can't do that from the air, you can only do that from boots on the ground, we might get a more anti-American, more anti-Israel regime in Iran that might actually go after a real nuclear weapons program, when this guy's dad wasn't really ever interested in that, according to international standards. He really was just kind of interested in like nuclear power. Again, not great for the world if Iran gets nuclear power. We're not that far away from a nuclear weapon then, but like if their aim is to actually make a nuclear weapon full bore, and we've got a more antagonistic Iranian regime, that's bad for everybody, like alive on the planet. So like this isn't great. And if oil creeps up to, you know, even $120 a barrel, that is going to really harm the oil industry in Oklahoma, because yes, the oil companies are going to be making out like thieves, but people are going to stop buying gas. They're going to stop selling to their major buyers, who are the plastics manufacturers, who are the manufacturing companies who need petroleum products. Like, that stuff is going to slow down, and it's going to leave the sweet spot of $80 to $90 a barrel.
Cost of everything will go up.
Yes.
Those of you listening on podcast have not seen me on video. Hopefully it doesn't show up in the video. Fighting with my camera. Grant, I moved my hands for 2 seconds, and then all of a sudden the Logitech webcam decided it needed to focus elsewhere. And I'm like, can we just get clarity?
I saw that and I was like, oh, I can vamp. I got this.
Right. Okay. Hey, you know what? That's one of the, you know, when you go from reporter to anchor of anything, your improvisational ability is super key. So thank you for that. Grant, I wanted to ask you about this because the mines are in the strait. So they're there. They're not easy to get out. And Iran has decided that, hey, look, you're going to destroy all our stuff. What do we have to lose? It just seems from everything you've described is that this is a road that we can't walk back.
Yeah, it's not exactly the point of no return for this war, but it is certainly we're getting to a point where the White House doesn't have control over this anymore. The president doesn't have the ability to say, I can declare victory and we could walk away. That used to be a thing that he could do. There was a way out of this where he could just say, victory declared, we won, and leave this thing. That's not a thing we can do anymore. This is the largest oil shock in global history. That was what economists said this week. So we're now in a place that the White House can't get their hands around this anymore. And that's a tough place to be. The control of this is in Iran's hands. Some of it's also out of Iran's hands because they've mined the strait at this point. So it's kind of just out there now. And that's going to change the calculus of how the president needs to do this. And as, you know, senators said this week, it looks like we are on a path to putting boots on the ground. And we might have forced ourselves into a situation in which that has to happen in order to force an outcome to an end, period, of this thing, regardless of what happens, because we don't have another option, because we didn't give ourselves an off-ramp to this, because there was seemingly no plan from the beginning. Because it did sort of seem like, and this is the reports we're getting from senators, both who are talking publicly, but also off the, or on background, I should say, anonymously is what that means, that the president kind of thought that they were going to, you know, hit Iran hard for the first couple days and then maybe be done with this thing by the opening bell on Monday. And
that's key, by the opening bell on Monday.
Yeah.
It just shows where the motivation is.
Yeah. And like I don't know if he didn't think that Israel was going to continue this fight, that Netanyahu didn't want, you know, and hasn't wanted to turn Iran into rubble for 40 years, which is, you know, what he's been saying, what he went on TV and bragged about in Israel. He went on Israeli media and said that. And so, like, I don't know if he just, Trump just didn't think he was serious or thought he was hyperbole or what, but yeah, we're at a place now in which we're limiting our options in how this ends. And some of those things are not in our control anymore. And that's a really tough place to be, especially when this war is increasingly unpopular. It is, and like, as a last point here, this war is the least popular war, if that makes the least popular war in American history since World War II. We don't have good polling for the start of the Vietnam War.
Yeah. Because I would think the Vietnam War would be the least popular of them all.
Right. Like, we're talking at the outset of wars. But what we do know is that wars get less popular over time, especially if we have boots on the ground. And this war is starting about like 10 points behind any other war. And that's not great. And Americans were promised this wasn't going to happen. Americans were promised we weren't going to get back into another, you know, forever quagmire kind of a thing in Iran. People in the Pentagon don't think that it's going to be sort of a, you hear the word quagmire a lot, that we're not going to get bogged down again in the Middle East. But it doesn't look like right now that we're leaving ourselves a lot of options outside of that.
So I'm going to ask a crazy question, and I mean no offense to the great men and women in uniform at all. But is this a situation where like the Joint Chiefs of Staff, the high up generals, really need to start pushing back a little bit?
So they have been, and there's been a lot of reporting about that. Even leading up to the start of Operation Epic Fury, there was a lot of report that General Will Kane, the Joint Chief of the Joint Chief Staff, basically was like, let's not do this. There are other options we have here. Let's work the negotiations more. Let's do this thing. And the president was for this. And then J.D. Vance pushed really forcefully for this, which has other things about J.D. Vance's personal designs being president and J.D. Vance's personal philosophies about the world, and the friends of J.D. Vance who have money stakes in the Middle East right now and what it would mean to have a much different Iran in that part of the world. And so J.D. Vance pushes the president in this, and Netanyahu has been pushing for this for the prime minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, pushes Trump over the line on this. And, you know, the president is the commander in chief. And ultimately, the Joint Chiefs are there to execute orders, give the president a suite of options, and then follow orders. They don't have to follow illegal orders, but as long as it's not illegal, they have to carry those things out. And so, yes, they're there to advise and they're there to give the best advice they can, but also they can't ignore some of these things. And so, yeah, in any other presidency, a president would defer to this is a room of all men, but, you know, this group of men, and this president is not one of those presidents. So there's that.
Well, and I mean, the West Wing School of Politics, mm-hmm. Susie Wiles should be up in his ear telling him this is a terrible idea. And he should be listening to it, because the chief of staff is that one person who is supposed to truly have the president's best interest at heart and the country's, and is supposed to be able to forcefully, you know, within reason, sort of challenge him.
As a gatekeeper of ideas and those things, but she, you know, has said publicly that she's not there for that. She is there to carry out the president's wills, and that's her idea. She is fully on board that the president's vision is the vision for the United States, and there is no deviating from that, even if the president deviates himself. And so that is her mission as chief of staff. And I think we're seeing that in spades when it comes to Iran. Absolutely.
And it may lay the template for future presidencies, where it's less about a grouping, a get together of the best minds, and more about thy will be done.
Yeah, basically. And that's a new kind of executive branch that we haven't seen. Not ever, but pretty close to ever in the White House. Yeah.
Right. So, Grant, what do you got going on this week? What is going on in the Make It Make Sense world?
The latest piece of reporting this week is about the Shield of Americas, which is this new Western Hemisphere initiative the White House has launched. While everybody has been focused on Iran, rightfully so, this thing's gotten launched. Kristi Noem, former DHS secretary, is going to be the special envoy and head of this thing. It is a agreement among 17 Western Hemisphere nations, mostly Central and South American nations, to use military force against cartels. Every single one of the nations we are partnering with now and giving access to our military are human rights abusers. And I go through that, and then it's not unlike the Board of Peace, in which we are, again, partnering with human rights violators in what appears to be the president's vision to have some sort of dark reflection of the UN that he is in control of. It is a fascinating story, one that I was kind of surprised to dig up because I didn't think it was going to be every single nation, but it is. So that's up there right now. And then this afternoon, in fact, in like 15 minutes from when we're recording, I have the fantastic attorney and host of the Law and Chaos podcast, Liz Dye, on the show. We're going to be talking about Ed Martin, who is the former DC U.S. District Attorney, who is finally got a bar complaint against him. We're talking about consequences against some of these DOJ attorneys. We are talking about the fact that using military lawyers in Minneapolis might have violated federal law, the Posse Comitatus Act, and that Pete Hegseth wants to overhaul what's called the JAG Corps. And then we're also talking a little bit about all things in the legal world this week, because it's not a world that I venture into all that often because I'm not a lawyer. And so I don't want to get some of those things wrong. She's always a great conversation. I'm really excited to talk to her. So that's this afternoon. And then the Make It Make Nonsense this week, I haven't quite landed on what I'm going to do yet. It might be a St. Patrick's Day thing. It might be an Oscars thing. I haven't decided. I'm going to call it now, though. I think I'm going to say One Battle After Another is the Best Picture winner this Sunday. But I think Michael B. Jordan takes it for Best Actor. I think that's what this
is. You know,
is.
I never know how those award shows are going to go. And I have to admit, I think the only movie I saw part of Hamnet the other day, which is very interesting. One Battle After Another was a masterpiece, I thought. It really was, man. It reminded me of when I watched Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
It's like, I'm going to need to watch this over and over.
It's that director's best chance. It's Paul Thomas Anderson. It's his best chance to win an Oscar. It's his biggest movie that he's done, probably since Magnolia. Like, I could do this in a different podcast for a long time, but like this might be the Make It Make Nonsense. I haven't decided yet, like I said, but like those are my picks.
Well, I've got a pitch for your Make It Make Nonsense. We should note that Oklahoma quarterback and Heisman winner Kyler Murray signed on with your Minnesota Vikings.
Yes,
which means
he did.
All of us in Oklahoma, we love us some Tampa Bay because of Baker and Philadelphia because of Jalen. But gosh, I think we're all rooting for Kyler Murray. And I sense a Sam Darnold situation here.
Look,
he comes in and elevates the Vikings.
I would love that to happen. You would look good in some purple, Brian. You could rock that. So like if this works, I would be first in line for a Murray jersey. I would absolutely do that. So I am like hoping for the best. But like I told you yesterday, I'm expecting the usual out of my Vikings. That is not a knock on Kyler Murray. But like, I am hoping for the best with this because anything is better than what we've been doing.
Hope for the best, but expect the usual.
Yeah.
Minnesota Vikings.
Yeah.
All right. Well, for all of you watching us on YouTube, be sure and leave a comment down below. Like and subscribe and go find Grant. Make It Make Sense with Grant Herms. And if you're on Substack, go find it at, I believe it's just Make It Make Sense. What is it? Mimspod.substack? What's the exact name?
Yeah, it's Make It Make Sense with Grant Herms on Substack. Mims News
Pod.
You'll find it.
All right. Fantastic. For Grant, I am Ryan. We will talk to you maybe not next week. It's spring break. I'm out of town. We'll see what happens, though. We will be back.